VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak, Dan Friedel, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Novak.
People from the poorest countries in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East are starting to receive COVID-19 vaccines. But the latest information shows that women are vaccinated at lower rates than men. Experts say women in Africa may be the least vaccinated population around the world, in large part because of misinformation and distrust. But problems getting the vaccine and inequality exist far beyond Africa. Barriers to receiving the vaccine include cultural opinions and a lack of technology. Women sometimes are not prioritized. Information about the rate of vaccine distribution to women is lacking in many countries. Officials agree, however, that women are clearly behind men in some places. Experts say the issue must be addressed for the world to defeat the pandemic. Claire Wenham is a professor of worldwide health at the London School of Economics. If women do not get vaccinated at the same rates as men, they will become even more marginalized, she said. This will just be one more instance where they are excluded from society. Sarah Hawkes tracks worldwide coronavirus information by sex at University College London. She said whether women were able to get the vaccine earlier in the pandemic was often decided by how countries gave out their first shots. She said Pakistan and other countries gave their first vaccines to groups like the military and immigrant workers, who are more likely to be men. Sasha Fahmy is a women's health researcher at the American University in Beirut. She said that in Lebanon, like much of the Middle East, women were protected from COVID-19 at first because they were more likely to follow social distancing guidelines. Over time, she explained, women faced higher exposure to the virus. Women are more likely to do household work and take care of sick relatives. Fahmy also said women were less likely to have information about the virus because they have lower reading rates. Naima Sadaka is a 36-year-old mother of three from southern Lebanon. She did not consider getting the vaccine because she believed there were scientific disputes about it, which is untrue. Since there are disagreements among the people of science over it, so better without it, Sadaka said. Many studies have proved all COVID-19 shots approved by the US and Europe greatly reduce the risk of hospitalization and death. In Bangladesh, the use of technology to increase vaccination rates may have hurt women. Government information from September showed that 8 million men, but just 6 million women, had received their second dose of COVID-19 vaccine. Ramesh Singh is the Bangladesh director for the organization CARE. After working on COVID-19 measures in some of the country's clothing factories, Singh noted that most of the workers were women. He said the factories have been open throughout the entire pandemic. That would seem to put women at higher risk because they're exposed, but they were not getting enough protection, Singh said. Singh explained that Bangladesh began vaccination efforts by asking people to register on a mobile app. Women who did not have mobile phones could not sign up. And while registration has now grown beyond the app, some women from rural areas still face barriers. Officials say that vaccinating more women in poor countries may depend on an important group, female healthcare workers. Women make up 70% of the world healthcare workforce. Research, however, has found women to be more distrustful of vaccines than men. Some female healthcare workers are also distrustful. I'm Dan Novak.
There are very few human workers at a new Nissan car factory outside of Tokyo. Most of the work is done by robots. The car maker said the factory should be running in the first part of 2022. Robots have worked for car makers for a long time, but humans were often needed to examine the quality of the machine's work. Now the machines are smarter. They use data and artificial intelligence to learn from mistakes and make corrections. Hideyuki Sakamoto is a Nissan vice president. He gave a tour of the production area in early October. He said robotic technology has made progress to the point that workers center their attention on maintaining the machines and studying data. The factory in Tochigi will produce three versions of a car called the Aria. It will make traditional gas engines, electric engines, and a hybrid, which combines electric and gas. The cars can all be made on the same production line. As the cars move, large robotic arms move cameras along the car surfaces to make sure there are no mistakes. Nissan said the developments at the Tochigi factory are likely to spread to factories around the world in time. One of the changes has to do with how paint is put on the cars. In the past, car bodies and bumpers on the front and back needed to be painted separately because they are made from different materials. Now, however, the parts can be painted at the same time. The new method reduces energy use by 25%. Another machine in the factory makes a part that is being used instead of rare earth magnets in the electric cars. Sakamoto said, "All the new methods should help Nissan save money and to faster deal with changes in the car market and worker availability." The company also needs to meet government requirements for limiting the release of carbon gases linked to global warming. Nissan expects to regain profitable operations this financial year. But the carmaker faced problems when its former chief, Carlos Ghosn, was arrested in Japan for financial wrongdoing. Ghosn then fled to Lebanon to avoid trial. I'm Dan Friedel.
The latest mission of the American Space Agency, NASA, will explore a group of ancient objects orbiting the Sun at the distance of Jupiter. Set to launch October 16th, the Lucy spacecraft is designed to study Jupiter's Trojan asteroids. These asteroids are small bodies left over from the formation of our solar system's large planets. They share an orbit with Jupiter as the planet goes around the Sun. The mission's aim is to gather new information about the solar system's formation 4.5 billion years ago. Lucy will observe 8 asteroids over 12 years. One orbits in what is known as the asteroid belt, an area between Mars and Jupiter. Most known asteroids orbit within this area. The spacecraft will also observe 7 Trojan asteroids. The Trojans circle the Sun in 2 groups. One group leads Jupiter in its orbital path, while the other follows behind it. Lucy will be the first spacecraft to visit these asteroids. There are believed to be more than 7,000 Trojan asteroids. Scientists consider the Trojan asteroids to be the ancient remains of the formation of the solar system. They have stayed captured in Jupiter's orbit for billions of years. Scientists hope that the NASA mission can provide new details about what conditions were like when the planets formed. They also hope the mission will lead to a better understanding of our own planet's history. The spacecraft was named Lucy after the ancient fossil discovered in Ethiopia in 1974. Lucy was one of the most famous scientific finds of the 20th century. The collection of skeletal bones gave scientists a better understanding of the evolution of humans. Kathy Olkin is a planetary scientist at the Southwest Research Institute in Colorado. She is the deputy lead investigator for the Lucy mission. In a video explaining the mission, Olkin compared the NASA spacecraft to the Lucy fossil. Just like the Lucy fossil transformed our understanding of human evolution, the Lucy mission will transform our understanding of solar system evolution, she said. The spacecraft, built by NASA contractor Lockheed Martin, is expected to fly within 400 kilometers of its targets. The spacecraft is equipped with several imaging instruments designed to capture information about the composition of materials on the surface of asteroids. Other equipment will be used to record asteroid surface temperatures and measure the size of the objects the spacecraft observes. Lucy will depend on solar power to operate. NASA says the mission expects to set a record because Lucy will be deployed farther from the Sun than any past solar-powered spacecraft. Hal Leveson is the mission's chief scientist. He recently told reporters that although the Trojan asteroids are in a very small area of space, they are physically different from each other. For example, they have very different colors. Some are gray, some are red, Levison said. He added that these differences suggest how far away from the sun they might have formed before getting to their current positions. Lori Glaze is the director of NASA's Planetary Science Division. She said, "Whatever Lucy finds will give us vital clues about the formation of our solar system." I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the summer of 1858, two candidates campaigned across the state of Illinois for a seat in the United States Senate. That seat belonged to Stephen Douglas from the Democratic Party. He was seeking re-election. His opponent was a lawyer from the newly established Republican Party. His name was Abraham Lincoln. Frank Oliver and Larry West tell us about this campaign of statewide but also national importance.
Abraham Lincoln proposed that he and Stephen Douglas hold several debates. The rules for each debate would be the same. One man would speak for an hour. His opponent would speak for an hour and a half. Then the first man would speak for half an hour to close the debate. Douglas agreed. There were seven debates in all. They were held in towns throughout Illinois. In some places, there was great interest in what the two candidates had to say. Thousands of people attended. Douglas was a short, heavy man. One reporter said he looked like a fierce bulldog. Douglas' friends and supporters called him the Little Giant. Lincoln was just the opposite. He was very tall and thin, with long arms and legs. His clothes did not fit well, and he had a plain face, one which many thought was ugly. He looked more like a simple farmer than a candidate for the United States Senate.
The Lincoln-Douglas debates covered party politics and the future of the nation. But everything the two men discussed was tied to one issue, slavery. Douglas spoke first at the first debate. He questioned a statement made in one of Lincoln's campaign speeches. Lincoln had said that the United States could not continue to permit slavery in some areas while banning it in others. He said the Union could not stand so divided. It must either permit slavery everywhere or nowhere. Douglas did not agree. He noted that the country had been half slave and half free for 70 years. Why then, he asked, should it not continue to exist that way? The United States was a big country. What was best for one part might not be best for another.
Then Douglas questioned Lincoln's statement on the Supreme Court's Dred Scott decision. Lincoln had said he opposed the decision, because it did not permit Negroes to enjoy the rights of citizenship. Douglas said he believed the decision was correct. He said it was clear that the government had been made by white men for white men. He said he opposed Negro citizenship. "I do not accept the Negro as my equal," Douglas said, "and I deny that he is my brother. However," he said, "this does not mean I believe that Negroes should be slaves. Negroes should enjoy every possible right that does not threaten the safety of the society in which they live. Every state and territory must decide for itself what these rights will be. Illinois decided that Negroes will not be citizens, but that it will protect their life, property, and civil rights. It keeps from Negroes only political rights and refuses to make Negroes equal to white men." "That policy satisfies me," Douglas said, "and it satisfies the Democratic Party."
Then Lincoln spoke. First, he denied that the Republican Party was an abolitionist party. "I have no purpose," he said, "either directly or indirectly, to interfere with slavery where it exists. I believe I have no legal right to do so, nor do I wish to do so. I do not," Lincoln said, "wish to propose political and social equality between the white and black races." "But," he went on, "there is no reason in the world why Negroes should not have all the natural rights listed in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." "I agree with Judge Douglas," Lincoln said, "that the Negro is not my equal in many ways, certainly not in color, perhaps not mentally or morally. But in the right to eat the bread that his own hand earns, he is my equal and the equal of Judge Douglas and the equal of every living man."
Lincoln then defended his statement that the United States could not continue half slave and half free. He said he did not mean that customs or institutions must be the same in every state. He said it was healthy and necessary for differences to exist in a country so large. He said different customs and institutions helped unite the country, not divide it. But Lincoln questioned if slavery was such an institution. He said slavery had not tied the states of the Union together, but had always been an issue that divided them. How had the country existed half slave and half free for so many years? Lincoln asked. Because, he said, the men who created the government believed that slavery was only temporary. Once people understood that slavery was not permanent, the crisis would pass. Slavery could be left alone in the South until it slowly died. That way, Lincoln said, would be best for both the white and black races.
Stephen Douglas and Abraham Lincoln were campaigning for a Senate seat from the state of Illinois. But their debates had national importance, too. Douglas expected to be the Democratic candidate for president in 1860. His statements could win or lose him support for that contest. Whenever possible, He tried to show that he was a man of the people, like Lincoln. He tried to show that his Democratic Party was a national party, while the Republican Party was a party only of the North. And he tried to show that Lincoln's policies would lead to civil war.
Lincoln, for his part, may have looked like a simple farmer, but he was a very smart lawyer and politician. He asked questions which he knew would cause trouble for Douglas. He wanted to create a split between Douglas and his supporters in the South. Lincoln also wanted to keep alive the debate over slavery. That, he said, is the real issue. That is the issue that will continue in this country when these poor tongues of Judge Douglas and myself are silent. It is the eternal struggle between right and wrong.
In Illinois in 1858, the state legislature chose the men who would represent the state in the National Senate. So Stephen Douglas and Abraham Lincoln had to depend on legislative support to get to Washington. On Election Day, the legislative candidates supporting Lincoln won 4,000 more popular votes than the candidates supporting Douglas. But because of the way election areas had been organized, the Douglas Democrats won a majority of seats. The newly elected legislature chose him to be senator.
Lincoln was sad that he had not won, but he said he was glad to have tried. The campaign, he said, gave me a hearing on the great question of the age, which I could have had in no other way. And though I now sink out of view and shall be forgotten, I believe I have made some marks which will tell for the cause of civil liberty long after I have gone. Many people, however, did not think Abraham Lincoln would be forgotten. His campaign speeches had been published everywhere in the East. His name was becoming widely known. People began to speak of him as a presidential candidate. To win the presidential election of 1860, the Republican Party had decided it needed a man of the people. He must be a good politician and leader. He must be opposed to slavery, but not too extreme. Many people thought Lincoln could be that man.
After the election in Illinois, Lincoln made several speaking trips in the western states. In none of his speeches did he say he might be a candidate for president in 1860. If anyone said anything about Lincoln for president, he would answer that he did not have the ability. Or he would say there were better men in the party than himself. Lincoln said, "Only events can make a president." He would wait for those events.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.